Spangola Speaks, and this is Deanna Spangola. I'm coming to you from the suburbs of Chicago. Thanks for joining me today on RBN for people who can handle the truth. Their website is republicbroadcasting.org. To see the guest lineup for this program and relevant links, please visit Spangola.com. During the program, email your questions or comments to Spangola1@yahoo.com. My regular email, which I do not access during the program, is Deanna@Spangola.com. You may join others in the chat room by clicking on the chat room button at my website or by going to Spangola.chatango.com. We will take calls in the second hour after we open the phone lines at 800-313-9443. My guest today is Roger Sayles. That is spelled S-A-Y-L-E-S. He is the author of From Sovereign to Serf, Government by the Treachery and Deception of Words. His website is serfs-up.com, and serfs is S-E-R-F-S. Welcome to the program, Roger.
Deanna, I am tickled to death to be with you and your audience today. I've been a listener of yours for some time, and I really appreciate your content and your professionalism. And from the other guests I've heard, especially recently, there was one on the other day that was raving about how responsive and attentive your audience is. So I'm really looking forward to the next couple hours.
Well, I hope that you're not going to be disappointed, and I can assure you that we do have a wonderful group of listeners, and they're very astute, and I'm certain that you have some information that they will really appreciate.
You know, Deanna, this has been such a wonderful experience for me because it's something I've been working at for 20 years. And this book is the accumulation of it, I guess, at that point. I started it originally in 2005, right after 9/11 was exposed, thinking that there were enough people awake because of the exposure of 9/11 that people would be ready to listen. I didn't have the whole picture that I have now back then. I tried to get people's attention, and it didn't get too much attention, and so I went ahead, and at that point I decided, I got a suggestion. I felt like I was being moved to leave the country, and so I did that and moved to Argentina back in 2008, where I still am domiciled, to use these correct words. And it was in that process that I found the last big piece of the puzzle. And it moved my knowledge and understanding from the tax side of the equation, if you will, over to the jurisdictional side of the equation. And so that's what the book is about, and it's my story. It's not just about that. I really tried to write it as a narrative, as my story. And in fact, the proof that I've beaten the federal government is reproduced in the back of the book in the form of an affidavit that was originally filed in the property records office of the county of my birth, which is Bay County, Florida, Panama City. And the reason it's filed there is to put it with all the other property that they own and tell them that you're not their property anymore. And we'll get into that in depth so maybe people can understand it as we go forward. But it's been really exciting, and like I said, this is accumulation, and it's not only my contribution of these 20 years, you also have my teacher's contribution in there. So that book represents 75 years of three men's lives, and my two teachers, of their 75 years, 15 of that was spent in federal prison simply for teaching this information. It's pretty serious stuff, and I think that it will, let's just say, it's extremely empowering. And we can pick that up and develop it a little bit after the break, because I hear your break music.
All righty. We will do that. Be right back in 3 minutes. Welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest today is Roger Sayles, who is the author of From Sovereign to Serf, Government by the Treachery and Deception of Words. His website is serfs-up.com. And Roger, you were talking before we went to the break that your book is a compilation of 75 years of experience among three people, and in another interview that I heard you do, you said you can't just spend a little bit of time and expect to get what you need. But you have compiled all of this information in a book, and those who read the book will benefit from three people because you have included your mentors in this book. And so I think it's a pretty good book to have.
It's, you know, I've had some incredible feedback, Deanna, and you hit a very key point, is that you're not going to read this thing if you're not familiar with this information and just go, well, I got it, and sail off into the sunset. Because here's what happens. Most people have no idea of what the real plot and scheme that's going on is, and when you understand and uncover this information, you have to go back and rethink your entire personal and world view in light of these new understandings. And it is going to hit some people so hard that it takes time. Honestly, you almost get the deer in the headlight thing, because all of a sudden you understand. And what I was saying about being empowering on the previous side of the break there was, and it's mentioned in the book from a psychiatrist, Dr. Bruce Lipton, who used to appear on a very popular morning show on another channel every morning, every now and then. And he said one day, I heard him on there, and he said, if you ever get your subconscious and your conscious mind working together, it's empowering. That's the exact word he used. And so as I started giving these this educational thing, but there wasn't even a book back then, on your network, as a matter of fact, in the evenings. And I had a listener from Eastern Tennessee named James Taylor call me, and James called and he said, you know, Roger, I'm 67 years old. I'm probably never going to do any of this. But he said, just knowing what you've taught me is empowering. And he used the same exact word, see. And I love the fact that you give both titles of the book, and I thank you for that. And I'd like to shed something with you on that, is that was the original title of the book, Government by the Treachery and Deception of Words. That's the way I think of it, and we added From Sovereign to Serf at the last minute, and both things are descriptive. I think the second part of the title is much more impactful in exactly what's been done, although the first part, that's what they've done. They've taken people that used to have God-given rights with constitutional protections. There's no such thing as constitutional rights, okay? There's constitutionally protected rights, and they've taken away those rights through trickery and treachery and deceit, and they've given you federal privileges called civil rights. And the reason this is going to press your buttons, Deanna, personally, is because I know that the 14th Amendment and a lot of this stuff is some of your real pet interests also. And what I think the information and the background will do for you, as well as your audience, is you're going to be able to tie a lot of things together that were disjointed before. Okay? So before we get into a bunch of that, let's go back and look at some simple concepts. I'm real big on quotes. There's a number of quotes in the book, because I think that's going back and taking very intellectual and thoughtful people through history and going to school on their observations. And I heard a quote that I really liked, and I found later how useful it was, and that was by Eleanor Roosevelt, not somebody that I particularly like, the Roosevelts, but I thought this quote was very insightful. I guess of the two, Eleanor was probably the better one. But she said, small minds talk about people, medium minds talk about events, and large minds talk about concepts. And so what I've been able to do since finishing the book, after starting to give the programs in May of year before last, is to take that idea, and instead of trying to give very complicated information, I like to work through concepts, because concepts are easier to understand. And what is interesting to think about is this: what they've done is extremely simple. How they've done it to fool you and defeat you is very complicated. So you don't go over and look at the complicated stuff, which we all, by nature, when you first find out about the beast, you go to the law library and start reading law books. Well, you're jumping right into the defenses they've built to defeat you. So the best thing to do is go around and approach it from the conceptual point, and that's kind of what we do. So, you know, I'd like to touch on a number of those things that are very important, because, see, my goal here is not to sell books, except to get the information into the public domain. But my goal here is to help educate people that have enough brain cells that are active and working, and care to internalize and understand the truth. I call it, of course, truth seekers, that these give you the tools. So it's not like Roger Sales said this, I want to teach you the concepts and you can go read the stuff and come to your own conclusions. Okay. I'm not telling you anything. I'm showing you what they've done to you, and I'm trying to duplicate myself, because that is going to be the success of this work, is how many of you can learn and internalize this, and some of you are going to want to pattern your lives after this. Some of you are going to just become empowered from understanding it. And at least I hope that all of you would expose yourself to the information, because it's very powerful and it has the ability to change people's lives, Deanna.
Oh, I believe that, certainly. And I was just reading over some of the things that in the opening of the book. And we have all certainly accepted the position that they would like us to be in, that we owe some sort of obedience to a federal government. We've given up state primacy and have accepted federal primacy, which is a term that you use in the book, or at least in the introduction. It is stated in the introduction, and. We are intimidated, certainly, by authority figures in this country. So, and there have been enough, and if you're talking about income tax and whatnot, there have been enough arrests and people who have spent time in jail for not paying their income tax that it gives us pause to think, well, do I want to end up in jail? Do I want to end up losing my property? And so we all back down. Which is what they'd like us to do.
Well, of course, and it's the intimidation, because their veneer, although it appears so substantial, is very flimsy, and that's why they have to put so much effort and time and money into the continued intimidation. On top of that, the more fear that they can instill in people, the deeper conditioning, Pavlovian conditioning, takes effect. Mm-hmm. And that's really what they're doing, is using Pavlovian conditioning here. And we'll probably talk about that a little bit more in depth. But let's go back to our basic concepts, because these things are important. You know, if you go to the Declaration of Independence, it says all men are endowed by their creator within or un, whichever way you want to consider it, unalienable rights. Well, it's got a capital C, okay, and it's got a capital R for rights. And later on in the Declaration, which I think is the greatest political document ever penned, by the way. And then you got a D, capital D for duties, and you got a capital C for citizens. Well, Jefferson told us in there that all men are created and endowed with these rights, capital R rights, by their creator. So if you want to go back, I've got a great quote in the book by Cicero. I'm not going to go to the trouble of reading it now, but Cicero says, even from time out of mind, men only get their rights from one of two places. You either get them from God or you get them from other men. There's no place else you can get your rights and your correlative duties than those two. So the question is, if you look in those original documents, you can see that you got your rights from a capital C creator, because Jefferson told us, and you see now that you're getting privileges called civil rights from the federal government and the imposed duties that correlate along with the privileged rights, small r, by the way. So how did that switch happen, and what is going on? And I guess the third question is it reversible?
Yes, that's probably the most important aspect of what you're presenting, and I believe that you wouldn't be doing it, you wouldn't have written the book, if it weren't reversible.
Well, it's my story. The proof's in there, and I can tell you my personal story is that I've beaten the federal government of the United States 3 times in the last 5 years with 5 sheets of paper, and they're reproduced in the back of that book. Now, if you want to back engineer that statement a little bit, this federal government of the United States is the most powerful government in the history of the world, financially, politically, and militarily, and they roll over for me with 5 sheets of paper.
And you didn't have to leave and go to Argentina to do this. You did it before. You just wanted to go to Argentina.
Well, I had made the decision to move because I didn't see any future in the United States, honestly. And also, I knew that I had this information, and I knew that I was going to continue throughout my life to try and get it into the public domain because God's been very good to me. And we'll get into a discussion in a minute, just I've touched on it, that rights and duties are correlative. Now, I've been able to access my God-given rights through my hereditament. I've done it 3 times with total tacit agreement of the State Department of the United States, which has the final authority on all matters concerning matters of citizenship. Okay?
Good.
And so I have accomplished that, and I did it once in the U.S., where I remained in the U.S. for 9 months afterwards, and then traveled out and traveled back in afterwards. And I've done it twice here because my first passport was stolen by another American. Isn't that nice? I had to get a temporary and then another permanent. And actually, the second one of those meetings was with the embassy gal that's in charge of the passports at the embassy down there in Buenos Aires. And I got to hand it for the first time, Deanna. And all these years, I got to hand that sucker to her, sitting across the table from her, and explain it to her. Okay?
Really?
And it was fantastic.
So you do have a passport, even though that's one way of declaring the jurisdiction of the government over our lives. We do have a quick break. We will be right back, and we'll pick this up on the other side. Is Roger Sales. He is the author of From Sovereign to Serf, Government by the Treachery and Deception of Words. His website is serfs-up.com. All right, you were talking about your passport, and in your book you talk about the passport being one of the ways in which we give jurisdiction of our sovereignty to the government.
Well, I think it's more important to say it's the way that you can declare your political status to the government. First of all, if you go all the way back to 1700s, because they trick you in a whole bunch of other ways, and I wasn't trying to contradict you, but, you know, it's important to be able to differentiate these thoughts and concepts once again, because it's my understanding and my feeling that what they're doing is they trick us with generalities and they come back and zap us with specificity. Okay, because they're using these words in highly technical, exact definitions. You are imputing a general definition that's incorrect and 180 degrees in the other direction, and they're coming back and zapping you, and you don't even know what the heck has happened. Okay,
mm-hmm.
So let's go to the passport application. I've got one right in front of my hands that I picked up back in 2007, I guess, in Florida at the post office. And before we go into the meat, let's go into the instructions. I think they may have changed this by now. They're trying to change the whole passport process, and I think it's because of this message, honestly. But here's one little thing here that is included in the book also. It's in the section that's highlighted that says paperwork reduction statement. And it says, you're not required to provide the information requested on this form unless the form displays a current valid OMB number. That's Office of Management and Budget. They have to get any forms that are used for collection of general purposes of information, an approval from the Office of Management and Budget that the forms are approved and they're correct in the questions and everything they're asking. We try to create forms and instructions that can be easily understood. Often, this is difficult to do, because our citizenship laws are very complex.
Ah.
Has anybody ever told you that the citizenship laws were complex, Deanna?
No. Well, not that I'm aware of.
Yeah, right. Well, they did right there. And in a pretty official form, because like I mentioned earlier, and you acted a little surprised, that the U.S. Department of State has the final authority in the federal government. The head knocker up there has got this final authority on all matters concerning citizenship and therefore political status. All right. Now, if you go back to the 1780s, whatever it was, a guy named Vattel, V-A-T-T-E-L, I believe, wrote a little treatise called the Law of Nations. It's been recognized by every country in the world, and those laws still underpin most of the world's countries' laws today. You see it referenced frequently at times. And in Vattel's Law of Nations, he says that every man has the right of political self-determination. Now, what does that mean? You got a choice, but they never have told you, have they?
No.
Okay. Well, you got a choice. Roger's telling you, and he's going to show you how they tell you. So if you'll go and get, this is on the printed form now. I know that they changed this stuff around on the electronic form, but you can find it in there. And you go pick up a passport application, and it says right at the top, U.S. Department of State, application for a U.S. passport. And then it changes fonts, Deanna, to a real small little font. Can you imagine that? And in bold letters, it says, warning. False statements made knowingly and willfully in passport applications, comma, including affidavits and other supporting documents submitted herewith, comma, are punishable by fine, imprisonment under the provisions of USC and this and that, and we're going to take away your firstborn male child and pump you where they're going to have to pump you daylight. Okay?
Wow.
So, but what are they really telling you there? They're telling you got a choice, aren't they?
Right.
But they're couching it in total intimidation terms in very small fonts. And I don't know how many millions, tens of millions of people have gotten a passport and looked at this and filled out this document, but I'm going to tell you I'm the first one that I know of that ever knew what they were saying and knew what this was telling me. Okay, because I don't know anybody else in the world that's figured out this scheme and can lay it out and explain it to you and show you, if you choose, where the remedy is to exercise to get your God-given rights back. And what I'm going to tell you in the audience is they can't do squat about it. Okay? Because they can't tell you what you are, because that's tyranny. But if they ask you what you are, Deanna, and you tell them, then ignorance of the law is no excuse. Deanna ought to know what she is, shouldn't she?
Right.
If I ask you if you're a citizen of the United States or a resident, and you say yes and sign some sort of a official document, well, you ought to know you're a serf, shouldn't you?
Yeah, that is kind of tricky.
You think?
Yeah, that is really tricky.
So let's go on through. We looked a little bit here in the instructions, but let's go to the big kahuna. And the big kahuna is the oath. Now, you know, Deanna and your audience, I have a tendency to call you Diana, and I don't want to do that. Deanna, and I know your audience knows, that any oaths that we take, they take pretty darn seriously. Would you agree with that?
Oh, sure, but they don't bother to take oaths themselves.
Yeah, well, if they do, they don't take them very seriously. And I think there's some answers to that dilemma, but let's go into the ones they want us to take here. They take this one for themselves pretty seriously, too, because what I think we can pretty well prove, Deanna, is that, you see, Satan's children are using God's laws and duties.
Oh, indeed. All righty, okay. We are going to a break. We will be right back after a word from our sponsors. Our guest today is Roger Sales. His website is serfs-up.com. He is the author of From Sovereign to Serf, Government by the Treachery and Deception of Words.
Now, that's for all the California people. That's S-E-R-F.
Right.
So, let me go back in where we left off, Deanna, on this oath on the passport. This is critically important, and I think it's going to shed a lot of light on what we've talked about so far. At the top of it, and with one of those hexagon lines around it, bold letters, exclamation point, stop. Do not sign application until requested to do so by person administering oath. So they take it seriously, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this is the oath. I declare under penalty of perjury, they like that penalty of perjury stuff, that I am a United States citizen, parentheses, or a non-citizen national, parentheses, and have not since acquiring United States citizenship, parentheses, or U.S. nationality, close parentheses, performed any of the acts listed under acts or conditions on the reverse side of this application form, parentheses, unless explanatory statement is attached, close parentheses, and again, I declare under penalty of perjury that the statements made on this application are true and correct. So a couple of points there. You've got two different political statuses, don't you? You've got a United States citizen and you've got this non-citizen national.
Right. Right. Excuse me.
And they talk about it twice in there. And then they mention this other thing right under it about if you haven't performed any of the acts and conditions listed on the reverse side. But here in the oath, Deanna, they put unless explanatory statement is attached. In the oath. Why, when there's two separate political statuses, do they hide that you can put statements and attach them up at the top of the form in little bitty letters?
Right.
You don't think they're trying to hide something, do you?
Yeah, I'm looking at the form right now. I mean, you can get it online, as you said. And it's very interesting.
Well, and this certainly, is a big kahoon. I'm sorry, go ahead.
And certainly there are two statuses. And we're so often we think, okay, we're not nationals, we're citizens. Everybody has been told that we're all citizens, at least those people who...
Well, you see, this is another chance where they're intermingling those words and confusing you in your mind, because a national is a citizen also. It's just the one with the capital C.
Okay. And the capitalization of certain words is very significant.
Well, of course. If I can find it here, I had it brought up on my computer. I always try and give credit where credit is due, because this is not all my work, you know. It's the greatest additions to what I've done, really, for me personally, in my understanding, have come from listeners after I started doing these shows, and people would send me things that added real big pieces of the puzzle. This one was a contribution of a fairly well-known attorney in our circles in the U.S. named Larry Beecraft. And Beecraft found this. Mr. Research stumbled on it one night, and this is not from the code. You know, there's two sets of law books in the law library. This is from the other book that nobody ever looks in, called the Statutes at Large. And, you know, if you go into that law library, Deanna, and you go over there and see the code and all those regulations for all the regulatory agencies underneath them, and then over on the other side is the Statutes at Large, a bunch of books. And if you go back to Volume 1, which was when we started this country, you'll find the first things in there are the Declaration of Independence, the Articles of Confederation, and the Constitution. Now, who do you think those law books apply to? Okay, so this is from that group of law books, all right? And this is called the Nationality Act of 1940. And I'm just going to read a little bit to you. Don't have to get into it in too much depth. Title 1, Section 1, the Act may be cited as the Nationality Act of 1940. And then, as they're prone to do, they list definitions, because they can identify whatever words they want to use throughout the rest of whatever they're writing there, okay? So, in Section 101, for purposes of this Act, under A, it says, the term national means a person owing permanent allegiance to a small less state. There's your state citizen right there.
Okay.
So, and you can see where they take that definition. There's some other things. Let me read B, because this one will even maybe clarify your point of a minute ago a little bit better. It says, the term national of the United States means, one, a citizen of the United States, two, a person who, though not a citizen of the United States, owes permanent allegiance to the United States. There's your capital C citizen. They say, though not a small c citizen. Okay? And then the third one says it does not include an alien. So what they've done is they couched that term and changed it back in 1940, right at the start of World War II, as they were setting this whole thing up. And then they took it over into Title VIII, and they twisted that definition of national to talk about Swains Island and American Samoa and outlying territories. Okay, so in that definition that's twisted in Section 8, outlying territories, although it leads you to believe it's Swain's Island, which I've never even heard of, or American Samoa, the other outlying territories include Washington, Texas, Colorado, California, Illinois, Georgia, Mississippi, etc. They've gone to great lengths to hide this. Okay.
And incarcerated a lot of people to conceal it.
Well, listen, what they've done is they've made you all property. Okay, and that's what we're going to go into, because this is what's going to really ring your bell, all right? This is going to put a lot of your 14th Amendment Civil War stuff and just tie it right all together, all right? Okay. What they did was in the Civil War was not fought over slavery. It was fought over taxation, and the real reasons it was started so they could run this system in and set it up is what I believe, because this was planned years in advance. This just didn't happen. I believe they probably started planning it when Andrew Jackson nixed the Second Bank of the United States. But what they've done, Deanna, is they've brought the feudal system from Europe and England into this country with the 14th Amendment. And that's not Roger saying that. I've got the reproduction in my book from a very, very highly high-profile Supreme Court case that you've heard a lot of about lately, and at least lately in the last few years. And that court case is styled U.S. versus Wong Kim Ark. And it was decided in the 1890s. And in that case, the reason I say you've heard it, Deanna, is because that's the case that all of the birthers use. Because it's the single biggest high-profile case in the entire history of the Supreme Court of our country that dealt with these matters of citizenship, denizenship, place of birth, nationality, et cetera, et cetera. Unfortunately, most of the people that read Supreme Court cases never read dissenting opinions. They only read the majority opinion. And if you go back to the dissenting opinion in that case, the sitting Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Chief Justice Fuller, weighed in the dissent. And I'll just quote to you from memory. It's a little more expanded in the book. But it says, if the amendment now bears the construction put on it, the 14th Amendment is what they're talking about, it brought the English common law rule, he's talking about feudalism, into this country for the first time, just as Great Britain was being relieved of its inconvenience. So when I tell you they brought the feudal system in here, it's not Roger Sales telling you, it's Chief Justice Fuller, a sitting Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court, in an extremely important case that was decided, and that's how he weighed in the dissent. So if you got a problem with that, go look up Chief Justice Fuller's grave and go argue with him, okay? Because those are his words, not mine. So it would be very instructional for us to understand a little bit about the feudal system if that's what this Chief Justice is telling us was brought in on us, don't you think? Okay, so the feudal system is an outgrowth of Rome, and we can go back and do some real in-depth conversation on this, Deanna, at some point in the future. Right now is not the correct time, but I think I've found the roots of their entire power base, and I think I can trace it all the way from the Babylonian Merchant Code to the UCC today and prove it, okay? So, but let's drop that and put that off to the side for a minute, and let's go back and look at this feudal era. The feudal era was mainly in Europe, and then the Pope evidently got William the Conqueror, the Duke of Normandy, to go across and take it over into England because they didn't have it over there and they wanted to impose their will on England, and this is how they did it. In that body of law, you had two different statuses. You had a serf and you had a lord. Okay, and the lord was the big kahuna of the manor, and the serf were basically slaves. And it's not basically, it's legally slaves. All right. Now, on the serfs, there was two different types of serfs. There was an involuntary serf that was born into a condition of servitude and could not literally get out with one exception. And then you had this other group of serfs that were called voluntary serfs. And their difference was they could volunteer into this position of servitude, but then when they wanted to, if they needed to, they could volunteer back out. Okay. And so that is what we've got, is that voluntary servitude impressed upon you. And in that body of law, with 1,000 years of legal precedent, that's an important point to ponder. We're not talking about chopped chicken liver here. We're talking about a body of law that's 4 times older than our entire country. And that's precedent, okay? Mm-hmm. In that body of law, if you were in either one of those conditions, involuntary or voluntary servitude, you were literally property.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And that's what they've done. And that's why they can come back and do all this stuff to you. And people are saying, it's unconstitutional. Those are against my constitutional rights. Well, first of all, there are no constitutional rights. There's constitutional protections. The Constitution doesn't give you one single right, okay? It protects the rights that God gives you. And it's to God that you owe your duties, all right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, but in this other section over there, it's you get these civil rights from the federal government, which are no more than privileges. And if you get privileges, then you owe those duties. And duties are things like adhering to regulations they write for you and paying your little income taxi-poo and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
All those things are correlative duties, see. And so, and we can get into this in much more depth. I'm just trying to give you, as a first-time introduction to these concepts, some basis so that we can move forward with total understanding, all right? Because that's real important here, is to learn basics. I'm real big on basics. So if you want to go into that a little bit, let me just spend a couple of minutes on it, because it's really, really important. Law is very simple. They make it complicated so they can monopolize it and screw you and use it against you, all right? But the law in its basic form is extremely simple. It is a very simple formula. If you've got a pencil and paper, you may want to write it down. If you've got the ability to write it there on the inside of your forehead, you can do that. It is R plus D equals R. Now, that's the entire body of every single serious jurisdiction of law in the world. Now, how does that equate? It is rights plus duties equal remedies. Rights and duties are plus because they're always correlative. You never just get rights. You always have associated duties. God gives us a right to life, correct?
Mm-hmm.
You got a duty to not go out and take somebody else's life.
Right.
See how this, you've always got a right and a duty that are correlative. And if either your rights are infringed upon or you don't perform a duty, on the other side of the equation is the remedy.
Okay.
That's law, okay? Now, to go back to our country's founding, in that founding document, it says all men are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights. Now, what Jefferson is telling us there, and for the primary form of status that was in our country originally, that it was founded on, that made us so vastly different, because there's only been two countries in the history of the world that had access to these, is we got our rights from God and we owe our duties to God, okay? Now, on the other side, you've been switched in, and they ask you these questions. I think it's deeper than that, but let's stick with that at this point. They ask you these questions. Deanna, are you a citizen of the United States?
I withhold that information right now until the end of this program.
But let's go retroactively a bit here. Over most of your life, and they ask you that question, what did you answer?
Oh, of course you always answer yes. You want to, because that's what we've been taught to believe.
What you've been conditioned to believe.
Sure.
And then you go down in some sort of a form, either at voter registration or this or that or a loan or whatever, and you sign it, don't you?
Sure.
You just told
And most of the time, you don't even read all of that fine print because they're sitting there watching you, waiting for you to put your signature down. They don't really expect that people are going to read that fine print.
Yes, the devil's in the details, Deanna. And the other big
literally.
Literally. The other big kahuna word here is resident. And that's the real landmine right there. Now, what they're doing with that, and you don't even have to go to a law dictionary to research this. You can just go to a Webster's Collegiate Dictionary and look at the term resident. And the first two definitions there, number one says, the act of living or dwelling in a place for some time. Fair.
Uh-huh.
B, the act of living or dwelling in a place for some time for the receipt of a benefit or the discharge of a duty. Bingo. You see, there's a geographical definition that they've imputed to you, and there's a technical legal definition that they're imputing on you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Because that receipt of a benefit or discharge of a duty is what we just discussed, our formula of law. A benefit is another word for a right. Okay? So There's your rights, and there's your duties, and there's your legal definition right in the Webster's Collegiate Dictionary, darling. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So those are the two right there that are the big kahunas. And we'll go back for a second and digress. I'm just kind of winging this today with you, Deanna, because I know that you and your audience have got a great deal of background knowledge here, and I'm not trying to muddy the water too much with a bunch of stuff, but lead us progressively to where you can easily see what's been done here. Let's go to the 14th Amendment. Any person born or naturalized in the United States, comma, and subject to the jurisdiction thereof, comma, are citizens of the United States and the state wherein they reside. It's the first time that word's used in the Constitution, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
So, what is that sentence really telling you? Well, if you don't know these basic concepts, these legal concepts, which they, you know, it's funny, Deanna, they really somehow don't teach these in law schools anymore.
Mm-hmm. Well, they don't teach a lot of things in law school. I mean, they teach you how to, write, certainly.
Mm-hmm. They teach you how to throw paper at each other and screw clients, okay?
Right.
you know the difference between a lawyer and a rooster, Deanna?
No.
The rooster clucks defiance.
Okay.
So you want to go back and take this little sentence here, this first sentence in the 14th Amendment, and we'll cover it, I guess, when we come back, because I don't want to get interrupted and leave it hanging.
Right. All right. We'll be back in 3 minutes. Stay tuned. All righty. Welcome back. This is Deanna. Our guest today is Roger Sales, who is the author of From Sovereign to Serf, Government by the Treachery and Deception of Words. His website is serfs-up.com. And, okay, we do have some questions being posed in the chat room.
Can we hold the questions?
We'll take care of those after.
Can we get some of the basics learned? Because I think some of the questions may be answered in what we're going to talk about. Okay?
Sure.
So if you go to the 14th Amendment and it says any person, well, when you see the word person, you know, Deanna, I've learned this 20 years ago, and I've asked people for 20 years, and I mean people like my dear friend Al Addisk and people, of, you know, what's the legal definition of person? And in 20 years, only one person's been gotten it right, and that's my attorney in Argentina, all right? And so a person legally is an entity to whom the law ascribes rights and duties. So it's not, are you a person? It's, which person are you?
Okay.
This throws a little bit of different light on it, doesn't it?
Sure.
So, any person born in the United States, rights and duties, don't forget that. Okay, which United States? You know, I can go to one of the older Black's Law Dictionary. They've purged this out of there now. But they used to take a cite from a Supreme Court case, and it says, this term has several meanings. And it gives three different contexts that phrase United States can be used. So, any person born in the United States, well, which United States? And subject to the jurisdiction thereof. Well, subject is an interesting word now, isn't it? Okay?
Yes.
Because we came from Jolly Old, and Jolly Old has a monarch, and they get all their rights from God, supposedly, because that's why they're coronated on that throne over there with that stone of Scion, or however it's pronounced, the sitting literally underneath the throne, is because that person is at least traditionally and conceptually in their government over there, the one that receives all the rights from God and has the duties back, and then the monarch has subjects, don't they?
Uh-huh.
So, you think that subject in the 14th Amendment might be the same type of subject?
Yes, given the people who wrote the Constitution. And I totally believe that the Constitution was devised not to protect us, but to protect the people, the class of people who wrote it.
Well, there's a lot of discussion on that, and some of those points may be very valid. I don't know. I haven't studied that. I have studied this, though. And by the time the 14th Amendment ran around, whatever was written those years earlier had been, you know, was being perverted as it was, or they'd have never pulled this scheme off. So, and subject to the jurisdiction thereof. Now, jurisdiction is an extremely interesting legal word because the whole thing revolves on that right there. Okay, the whole nexus of everything is, how do those guys over there, did they change from me getting my rights from God to me getting my civil rights from them and them imposing these duties on me? Okay, that's jurisdiction. You want your jurisdiction to be in heaven, or do you want your jurisdiction to be in Washington, D.C.?
Well, I would like to be, of course, an independent person, and I think we can be, I'd like it to be in heaven. We should all be independent and make choices for ourselves, dependent upon our value system, and not be governed by a group of men in Washington. So we do need to take our 60-second top of the hour break. We will be right back after a word from our sponsors. Welcome back. This is Deanna. And our guest today during the second hour is Roger Sales, who is the author of From Sovereign to Serf, Government by the Treachery and Deception of Words. His website is serfs-up.com. And over the break, I was looking at some other things relative to the Constitution and the fact that it was actually changed before the so-called Civil War. And things were changed, the amendments and things, the use of punctuation, spelling, capitalization, signs and symbols. And we got something totally different than what was originally conceived.
It was a coup.
Yes.
When you really get this thing in its totality. But let's go back to our little coup d'etat was the 14th Amendment. And the jurisdiction thing we were talking about right before the break is a legal concept that comes out of that feudal era. And the concept and the term is based in the concept of protection for allegiance. They give you protection, you give them allegiance. It's kind of like this rights and duties thing, see? And, of course, in the feudal era, the serfs would be on the manor, and if they got raided or whatever, the lord would get them across the moat and pull up the gate, and they'd all fight for the manor. And then if he needed to, that they would receive his protection, and, of course, they were on his land, and they cut a deal with him where they gave him a percentage of whatever they grew and raised in a calendar year, etc. And that is exactly the system that's been imposed on us. And subject to the jurisdiction thereof, our citizens of the United States, so there's that new political status, and the state wherein they reside. And that word is so critical, and the way that it's being used is this, Deanna. The definition of the word that they're imputing here comes out of ambassadorial law, when countries would change exchange ambassadors and sign treaties. And so let's just take Argentina for an example. If the Argentine ambassador gets caught coming into DFW up there with a kilo of cocaine in his diplomatic pouch, they don't throw him in the slam up there in Washington, D.C., do they?
They probably share it at a party later that night.
Probably let him in and roll out a red carpet. Good answer to him. No, they put him on a plane in our hypothetical situation. They'd put him on a plane and send him back to Buenos Aires because he is in residency there. And what that means are the laws of Argentina apply to him, and not the laws of Washington, D.C. and the United States. So consequently, how are they using that term in the 14th Amendment? They're using that term because what they did was they had a group of people that were property before the Civil War, the black people. They were the objects of someone's property right. Now, there's another important legal concept to understand, because when we use the word property, we think of it as, let's say that your car out there, Deanna, and you go, that car is my property, right? That's the way mm-hmm. you use that word. But that's not how it's used legally. Property is a right. In the law, the car is a thing. So your right of ownership is the ownership in and to the car, not the car.
Okay.
All right. So when they say reside, they took these black people that were property, the object of someone's property right, and after the Civil War, since they changed the Civil War halfway through to the slave issue to set up this 14th Amendment thing, then they had to give them this new political status called a citizen of the United States. And in doing so, many of the southern states especially didn't recognize that political status. And so the newly citizens of the United States, the secondary citizenship brought in, because you can't believe the white men that ran the country gave these poor illiterate blacks the same status they did. That's a fairy tale. Okay?
Right. All righty. So we'll pick it up in a second. Okay, we'll be back in 3 minutes after a word from our sponsors. And our guest today is Roger Sales, who is the author of From Sovereign to Serf, Government by the Treachery and Deception of Words. His website is serfs-up.com. And right before we went to the break, we were talking about the so-called Civil War, which freed the slaves and reduced everyone to the same status. And that status is as a debt slave. And they have then imposed Rothschild's European plan on everyone in America.
Let me touch on a couple of the fine points. They didn't bring it in for everyone originally. This happened in stages, all right? And it wasn't for everyone because in the benchmark landmark case, the first important case on this 14th Amendment called the Slaughterhouse Cases, they very clearly say that there's two separate citizenships in the country then and refer to it a number of times in that case. So the important sites are contained in the book, of course. But back to the conceptual thing of resident that I was trying to set up there, when the black people in the states were not recognized as the new citizen with these new civil rights after the Civil War, then they had to get protection from the federal government to protect these new federal rights. And there's your definition of jurisdiction. They asked for protection, therefore they gave their allegiance. There's detachment, and that's how you've been switched. Now, originally, after the Civil War, the deciding concept, if you will, or case, was a case called Plessy versus Ferguson that you may have heard referred to if you've done any civil rights stuff. And that was the case that came with the decision that said separate but equal. And that set up black and white bathrooms, black and white water fountains. And it's kind of a despicable part of our history, but it's the history. It's what happened here.
Right.
And so you had that all the way up until that case that we referred to earlier, U.S. versus Wong Kim Ark. Well, obviously, Wong Kim Ark is not a black man. He's a Chinaman. Mm-hmm. And that came out of the backlash against all the Chinese immigrants. We don't have time to go into the whole setup of the case. It's an extremely interesting case. If you're interested in these issues, like I said, it is the single highest point case in the entire history of the Supreme Court on these issues. But what they did with the Wong Kim Ark case was they laid the groundwork for everybody. The trap was laid with the 14th Amendment. The trap was set with Wong Kim Ark, and it was sprung during the Depression of the 30s. So what this tells you when you understand this is these guys are working at least on an 80-year-plus timetable.
Right.
Now, they're working on an 80-year-plus timetable with all this treachery and deceit that we haven't even really delved into very much here so far today. And you don't even understand the meanings of the words that are being used. Deanna, who the hell you think is going to win that battle?
Well, of course they are. It was designed that they would win.
And so, you know, this is the first time this information has been widely disseminated in the public domain. My teachers had all of the tax side of the knowledge, and that's what I had studied and knew inside out for many years, 15 or more years. And when I saw that passport application and I saw that word U.S. national with that differentiation in the oath, now I knew what they called us. You see, I always knew that there was two different statuses, but they change it in the code and in the regulations. You know, they'll call it a resident somewhere here. They'll call it a citizen of the United States here. Over in Title 42, Section 1981, it says the citizen of the United States is entitled to all the privileges and immunities of the white citizens. It calls them white citizens right there in Title 42 of the code. Now, that's mm-hmm. Congress being racial, not me. Okay, mm-hmm. So they change it around, but I knew that the State Department was in charge of all of those matters from a letter I'd gotten from the state of Florida Attorney General years earlier asking him for a letter or documentation that I was a Florida state citizen, because we're still going on the state citizen idea that's in the old Supreme Court cases that was the representative term that identified this status back then. But all they've done is change the words. The concept is still there. They just changed the label.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they do over and over and over and over again. What's free trade? Free trade's mercantilism.
Right.
It's the same old pig with a different color lipstick and a different little skirt, and they just trot it right out.
Mm-hmm.
What are Zionists? This is a favorite topic of yours. I'm going to prove to you. The Zionists are nothing but the Pharisees.
Mm-hmm.
You're dealing with Phariseeism. You're dealing with the same monetary system and the same legal system that the tribes of Judah and Benjamin brought back from Babylonian captivity and instilled back into Jerusalem. It wasn't until 500 years after they were released that the Babylonian Talmud was written. These are the principles that are infused in that Talmud. This is the root of their power, is making people property through these little mechanisms contained in the merchant law.
Mm-hmm.
This is the big secret here, okay?
Right. And yet we're all under this law because of...
You're all under it right now. Now, for people that have a hard time differentiating this, let me try and simplify it for you. If you want to understand what's being done here, key in on the administrative agencies, because the administrative agencies are their enforcement and control arm, and they didn't start coming in until the 30s when this system was being imposed.
Right, okay. And then they totally put them in 1947 with another coup.
Yeah, they've been pretty active all along. If you go back to those two sets of law books we touched on earlier, Deanna, you've got the United States Code over on one side with all of the accompanying regulations. And what happens, the way we make laws is this. A bill's either introduced either in the Senate or the House. It passes both bodies. If it's not the same and compatible, they go into a committee and try and hammer out something that's acceptable to both bodies. Then when they do that and have agreed there, they send it over to whoever's the puppet up there in the White House, and he signs it. And at that point, it's law. Okay? And at that point, it goes over into the statutes at large as a public law. They also take it and give it then over to the administrative agencies, and they promulgate regulations so that they can impose public policy.
Right. And Congress does not even write those laws.
No, they're written by bureaucrats.
Right.
And that's why it's public policy, is because the Congress is right. They did write the law, but then it got changed over in, and the administrative agencies interpret the law and change it into public policy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you go to this Code of Federal Regulations, an administrative agency or a regulatory agency, by their very name and nature, administrate or regulate, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So, but the question is not that. The question is, who do they regulate? Can they go over to China and pick up some coolie out of the field and start bapping him with EPA regulations?
Nope.
They got to have somebody specific that they can regulate and enforce that stuff and write all that garbage for, don't they?
Sure.
Now, if you go to all of the Code of Federal Regulations but one, we'll come back and touch on that in a second. All the other 49 codes have their jurisdictional statement right on the first page. And it says residence.
Okay.
Residence.
Okay.
And that one that's different is Title 26, and that's the Internal Revenue Code. And the Internal Revenue Code says in Section 1.1-1A, I don't like to throw that stuff out there and get people confused, but that's where it's at, 1.1-1A. And it says an income tax is imposed on all individuals who are citizens of the United States and residents, and to the extent of 877B and 871B, all non-resident alien individuals. Now, what are they saying?
What are they saying?
What they're saying is they've taken that U.S. national term and they've hidden it so you can't recognize it for everybody that was saying it, because if it said an income tax is imposed on all individuals who are citizens of the United States and residents except for 871B and 877B upon all U.S. nationals, and you're going, well, there's only two sections of this shooting match that apply to these national guys. I want to know who they are.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Okay? So they couldn't do that. They had to couch it in their little treachery and deceit in the term non-resident alien. Now, we've discussed the term resident a little bit already, haven't we?
Right.
So let's take a step further and analyze it, see if you agree with this term. You're either pregnant or you're not pregnant.
That's true.
Okay. Well, you're either a resident or you're a non-resident.
That's
so. If you're not a resident and being locked into the jurisdiction, then you're non-resident, aren't you?
Right.
And if you've got a separate status, then that other status is alien to the 14th Amendment political status, isn't it?
Right.
So you're a non-resident alien in the tax code. Now, you think I'm pulling that out of left field? I'm going to tell you to go back to the very first case that was decided after the 16th Amendment. It's a very famous case called Brushaber versus Union Pacific Railroad. And the issue came up and was brought up in his trial that he was a non-resident alien. It was not decided on. But in every important tax case, the Treasury Department writes a thing called a Treasury decision. And I went to the Emory Law Library, Depository Law Library, right there in Atlanta, Georgia, and I went and looked at this with my own eyes. I went back to the set of books that's got Treasury decisions in it, and it's 2314, I believe. And it says, Frank Brushaber, a citizen of the state of New York and a non-resident alien.
Okay, so you have to be a citizen of the state that you reside in order
You don't want to reside.
Okay.
If you reside, you're a federal citizen because you're asking for the federal government's protection.
Okay, so he's domiciled?
Correct.
Okay.
Or dwells, or however you want to use it, but you got to be very conscious of these legal landmine words. So that is how they've hit it there. Now, conversely, on the passport application we looked at, it says, I certify under penalty of perjury that I'm a citizen of the United States, parentheses, or a non-resident alien. Well, they couldn't use it over there because anybody's going to be looking at a passport application and says, well, what's a non-resident alien doing applying for a passport?
Exactly. All right. We do have to go to a break. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest today is Roger Sales. He is the author of From Sovereign to Serf, Government by the Treachery and Deception of Words. His website is serfs-up.com, and that's spelled S-E-R-F-S. And we've got callers lining up,
I'll just put one little confirming bit of interesting information here. And if you want to take some calls, I'd be glad to. We'll digress a bit, and both in our lives and in the material, and go back to the nursery rhymes, and that would be Alice in Wonderland. And this quote's in the book. It came out of the first page of a legal research book when I studied to be a paralegal and went through that curriculum. And it's published by Nolo Press out there in Berkeley. And this was a whole first page in that book, Deanna, and it says, when I use a word, Humpty Dumpty said in a very scornful tone, it means just what I choose it to mean, no more, no less. The question is, said Alice, whether you can make words mean so many different things. The question is, said Humpty Dumpty, which is to be master. That's all.
Yes. How true. Well, let me ask a question first from the chat room.
Okay,
can you please ask your guest about our rights to water? I think it is in the 10th Amendment. Do we have any rights to what goes into our homes, such as smart meters, water? When can we say no if we don't want something?
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, then let's see if we can address this way. We talked about your property being your car and it technically being a thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you've got property rights in and to the thing, your car, you can pretty well do whatever that car you want with, except, you know, go harm somebody else, can't you? You can let it run out of oil. You can go drive it over a cliff. You can do anything you want with that thing in the eyes of the law because you have the property rights in it, correct?
Right.
All of those federal agencies only regulate residents. And if you're a resident under the feudal system, you are their physical property, and they can do or say whatever they want to do to you. You do not have access to the 10th Amendment and God-given constitutionally protected rights. You are a federal serf citizen.
Okay. So we do not want to be citizens.
Or residence.
Or residence.
Those are both synonymous. Those are both terms right there in that 14th Amendment. And that term resident is the most trickiest of all of them because you never impute a legal definition into that word. And that's exactly how it's being used. In the law library, Deanna, there's a group of books called Words and Phrases. And what that group of books does is it takes important words and phrases in all these different cases, and it compiles them in the word or phrase. And if you go into the words and phrases and look under resident, there's an entry in there from some case, I don't remember which one, and it says the term resident used in any legal context is always political. Doesn't say sometimes, it doesn't say part of the time. It says always political.
Okay. All right.
So, did you have some callers?
Yes. Let's take Werner in Canada. Werner, welcome to the program.
Werner, I'm so happy to talk to you.
Oh, I don't know if it's worth mine.
I've heard you call in on a bunch of shows, and I always really, really admire what you have to add. So nice to meet you, and thanks
same
for all your good
to
work.
Me. And but it's so sad that you have to leave your homeland and go somewhere else.
It's
so sad that you had to leave your homeland and go to another country.
Yes, but, you know, it's been a great experience for me, this move, and I really like it down here.
Yeah, and but as I say, I wish sometimes that a lot of people here from North America, under peaceful circumstances, that they would have lived for a while in some other countries around the globe. Because what I've seen here, local people, once they had been abroad, it basically opens up their mind.
It's been a really neat experience. I had never lived anywhere in the world, and that was part of my motivation, too. It wasn't all political, just a large part of it.
Yeah, adventure.
Yes, part of that.
You know, I wanted to make one point. When the early settlers came over here, they were escaping from all the oppression, especially in Europe, you know, from the feudal system and everything. But the way it is always, you know, when the host moves, the parasites follow.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, that's very true, Werner. Well, you know, I'm happy to tell you that the Sales family was on the Mayflower, and my family was integral in starting this country, and that didn't mean too much to me when I found it out when I was younger, but these days that means an awful lot to me because I really got a dog in this fight, okay?
Uh-huh. And then gradually, what I call the parasites, they sneaked in underneath the wire, all the very same restriction in what the way they have been basically enslaving the people over there in Europe.
Yes, and they've been doing it with this mechanism of the merchant law. And if Deanne will have me back sometime when we've got enough basis laid where everybody can follow it, I'll go back and trace the whole thing for you and tell you where I think I've found the absolute root of their power base, Werner.
Yeah, but as I say, you made a good point when you mentioned about the Babylonian Talmud and
yes.
The comparison to the Pharisees at the time when the Lord was walking the earth. You know.
Well, I will, probably not today, maybe so if I can drag it up quick enough, I'll read something on the air from a book called Historical Jurisprudence about Babylonian Law, and it'll just make your jaw drop, the similarities you're living in today.
All righty, gentlemen, we've got a break. We will be back in 3 minutes. Stay over, Werner, if you'd like. Welcome back. We have Roger Sales, the author of From Sovereign to Serf, Government by the Treachery and Deception of Words, on the program today. His website is serfs-up.com, and we have Werner in Canada on a call.
Hey, Werner, would you like, let me read you this little bit about Babylonian law here. This is from a book from John Hopkins University written in 1921 called Historical Jurisprudence. And I'm just going to read a small section to you here. And this is subsection A under Master and Servant. A man might well make a contract with another man whom he hired for a year or whom he contracted to serve for a year. Example, in connection with this contract, it should be noted that Uberu was regarded as a free agent hiring himself out. But since he enters into a relationship with his master, in which he is temporarily in the condition of a slave, he is representative or guardian. In the case of a slave, the name of the slave's father is never given. The slave is not regarded or spoken of as a man, but as a thing, and is reckoned in the same way as cattle. The actual point of this contract is the transfer of the right to a man's services. Such a transaction is but a part of the whole Babylonian system, whereby every credit or right was passed from one to another by means of contracts. The law was very strict as to the beginning and termination of these contracts. If the servant did not appear, he could be arrested and brought into his master, and he was his master's man. This species of slavery was of great importance and very customary in old Babylon.
Interesting. Cattle. Hmm.
See, it's all in there when you start piecing this together, Deanna and Werner and whoever else is interested. You're going to find some of the big answers right here. I can take the examples out of this Babylonian law, trace them up to the Pharisees, show you where they changed laws, Rome's laws from the jus civil, which is the law of the citizens, to the jus gentium, which is the law of the foreigners, which later morphed into Roman civil law, which then morphed into the feudal era, which then went to England and now is in the U.S. And you can trace it 2,000 years back through the remedy. You don't look at the rights and the duties, you look at the remedy, because there's a unique remedy there that has been available all those years, which is called self-help. And self-help remedies are the remedies that can be exercised without having to go to a formal court and get a judgment. In other words, if you don't pay the IRS, they come and grab your stuff, don't they?
Mm-hmm.
And what are self-help remedies? Lien, levy, garnishment, seizure.
Right.
Same deal. There. What does the Bible say, Deanna? There's nothing new under the sun?
It always gets recycled.
Yep. They just changed the words. They changed the words. It's not the Babylonian merchant law that morphed into the law merchant. It's now called the Uniform Commercial Code.
Well, the same way the last few hundred years, you know, from Illuminati to Bilderberger and all the different faces and disguises, it's always the same click.
It's always the same click, and it's always the same techniques. Now, why is this really all that important? It's not just that you assume these God-given rights again, but when they've made you legal property, I believe, and I think it's, you're never going to find the law here because they got this buried real deep. But as property with a birth certificate, you're pledged as collateral for the bonds which back the world's reserve currency. That's why your income tax goes straight off the top to the bond holders, because the bond holders hold the bond which is secured by the collateral. You know, the root word of bond is bondage.
Mm-hmm. And that's where the people tried to get away from when they came, when they left Europe, a few hundred years ago.
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely.
And they're busy, as I say, the justice system is basically run by lawyers. They make an oath to a foreign entity located in London.
Right.
Now, where are their loyalties? Are they with of the country, or are they their loyalties with a former slave master?
Well, I'm going to tell you that they make their jurisdictional statement in the first paragraph of any lawsuit you ever care to read, and it's going to say Deanna Bengola, a resident of, boom, jurisdiction, bam, right like that.
Huh.
And you didn't even know what they said.
Right.
Justice for the people by the people, and that has basically been thrown overboard because people have become too complacent.
Sure. And ignorant.
Don't knock it, we never might get it as good again. This is what I heard about 30 years ago from people.
Right.
Well, you know what I've been so fortunate with God's help to find is the trap door where you can volunteer out. Now, I don't tell people to do that, okay? I tell you that there's a choice available, and if you want to educate yourself, you can learn about it. And if you feel motivated, if you're going to go asking for God-given rights, you better go get down on your knees and pray to him and ask if that's what that he wants you to do and if that burns the fire of liberty in your heart. Okay? And the first thing I tell people, they say, what should I do first? You make this information yours. You learn it backwards and forwards, because if you do decide to take that step and do this, you're the one that's going to have to defend it.
Right.
And believe me, you're going to have to defend it.
Well, right. As I say, it's better than going to university. Listen to RBN, to Diana's program, and so on, and to you, Roger. You know, there are great guests on, and it is quite an education. I wish I would have taken it already decades ago.
Well, I told Deanna when she asked me to be on, I told her I was a reforming Alex Jones listener.
Oh. Well, if you were still listening to him, you wouldn't be on. All righty, Werner, we do have a bunch more callers lined up, so we're going to catch
you.
Thank you so much.
Werner. Nice to meet you, man. I really admire what you do.
Hey, no. I'm just bumming through here.
Okay.
Okay.
Bye.
See you, man.
All right, let's take Richard in Washington. Richard, welcome to the program.
Yeah, great program, very succinct presentation, and you may have covered it. I missed a little of the first. How do you think the Emergency Banking Act and the enemies of the United States, revised in 1933, affected this whole kind of presentation? And have you ever run across the 40 outrageous facts that nobody knows?
I think I've seen that, and some of those are accurate, and some of them I had some problems with. If you go back to Roosevelt's declaration when he basically the country was bankrupt, he says that they put in the Trading with the Enemies Act, and who's it for? Citizens of the United States. There's a great quote in my book, Richard, that's straight from William T. McFadden on the House floor of the House of Representatives, not during special orders like they do now, and he lays out the whole story there in several separate quotes that are included in the book, and there's no doubt what went on.
Well, that's my understanding, too. And then since they bankrupt the corporation, I believe they put it in receivership. That was the way they wiggled out of the Federal Reserve System into the IMF. And I just wondered if you had any comments on that.
Well, the Secretary of the Treasury and the Attorney General are both employees of the fund. And if the Secretary of the Treasury is paid by the fund, he ain't looking out for your best interests, I promise you. You can get into this real in depth, and what I've come to conclude, see, I'm still learning and understanding this after 20 years and being as immersed in it as I am. But what I think is happening here is in the feudal system, if your parents were in a position of servitude and they were voluntary serfs and you were born into a position of voluntary servitude. But because you had that voluntary servitude in your background, you could volunteer out even though you were born into that condition. I think they passed the birth control or birth certificate thing back in the early 20s to set this thing up for the 30s 10 years later when they knew they were going to pull the string and they'd already have collateral there that would spawn future generations of little serfs. And that's why I believe that they say the law runs under presumption. They're presuming that you're a serf and they continue to ask you those questions to continue to tie you down.
Well, that's what I'm thinking, too, but I'm thinking the 1933 Act actually changes from humans into, as you pointed out earlier, animals, so they don't even have that consideration. They assume that we're domesticated animals, and they treat us as such.
Well, you know, that's Al Adask's findings and personal experience, and, you know, Al found another way out, but I didn't have to go to court and get $9 million a year potentially put on me to do mine. And the nice thing about this approach is that once you get the head office of the federal government to agree with you, then you go down and unzip the administrative agencies, because administrative agencies are courts of record, too, okay? And you don't have to go to court. If you just do this and try and do it on a case-by-case basis, and there's people that have been successful doing that, but every time you get a traffic ticket or you got to go in there, you got to reassess it. If you go to the State Department and get their approval, you just show them your documentation and your passport. Hey, your boss said that that's what I am. What are you doing questioning them?
Well, that's it. I look forward to reading your book. It's always been on my list. I just haven't got around to it. I open it up to other callers.
Okay, all right. Well, let me add this then for Richard, because we've been able to drop the price. You know, I'm new at this, and we're fumbling our way through this thing. The price of the ebook is now $14.99. The printed version is $24.99. But we've got a Christmas special in, and if you'll buy 10 or more of either the tax book that my teachers have written or this book, we'll give them to you for $14.99. But you have to call somebody to get that done. And you need to go to thebookshelf.us. thebookshelf.us and call that number and tell them you want the Christmas special.
Okay. Got it. Okay.
You have to get freedom this Christmas, Deanna.
All right. We have another Richard. He is in... Where is he in? He's in Alabama. Yes, he's in Alabama. Welcome to the program, Richard.
Yeah. I got this book called Law Among Nations.
Yes, by
it refers to the Convention on Questions Relating to Conflict of Nationality Laws, 1930, Article 6, says a person possessing unwanted nationality acquired involuntarily was entitled to renounce nationality, but only with the permission of the state whose nationality he desired to surrender.
Well,
how does that conflict with your book?
Well, it doesn't conflict with my book, really. If you go back to the principle, if they tell you what you are, it's tyranny. If they ask you what you are and you tell them, well, heck, you ought to know what you are. What you do in this process is you learn this material, and, you know, I don't sell you, I'm not trying to sell you a bunch of stuff, okay? I tell people, you write your own documentation or affidavit. Now, we'll certainly help you and give you any, answer any questions that you have, but this is your political status that you're going to declare. I'm not telling you what it is or what to do. I don't know your background. Were both your parents American born?
Yeah.
Well, that's the one key thing, is your hereditament. Both of your parents had to be natural-born Americans. See, this is the thing Obama's been fighting on, this birth certificate thing, is this hereditament issue. Okay? And if that's the case, and you feel like moving forward and you want to draw out your sword and be a warrior, then you can do this. But you write that out, because I know if you've written it out, you're at least somewhat familiar with the concepts. And then you simply submit it to the State Department for a passport application and let them make the decision. They can't say no.
I've already filled out a passport application that says that where I answered no to that question about U.S. citizenship, and I got my passport, and it looks identical to the others.
Well, yes, they're not going to let the sheep have something different where you can go run around and look what I got, I'm different. But you look in there in the language, it says citizen/national. It's for both. Where they have the determination is in their database.
Mm-hmm. So the possession of that passport doesn't prove anything, really.
Well, did you submit documentation with your application, or did you just send one in and say no?
I just sent in the application.
You got to. It says right there at the top that if you want to attach documents, you got to make some kind of a declaration. In other words, you know, they'll let a lot of people expatriate. That seems to be a big deal now. But if you want to expatriate, you're still a serf, and you got to go get another passport from another country, go through all their bureaucratic hoops, and then trade passports. But they don't throw you in jail or stop you.
Mm.
You know, the reason they don't is because that's your decision. That's not their decision. And if you want to conversely change from that slave political status over to the free men political status that your hereditament bears and entitles you to, that's your decision.
Yeah. I've heard they've changed the law on tax deficiencies so they can, I can't remember how many years after you go to Argentina or something.
Well, they tried to put a threshold in there for limits, and I think the one that I saw discussed was if you had more than $50,000 in back taxes. Now, when they're going to do that, they got to write a regulation and send that regulation through the promulgation process, and I don't know whether that regulation has been promulgated yet or not, honestly, to where it's active on the serfs. And somebody's going to have to research that. You know, I cleared up my IRS problem a long time ago. I've been out of their system for many years, thank goodness.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't know to do this State Department thing first. Because you know, a lot of people had problems with the IRS is their teeth, you know. And they're not going to let you out of the pen very easily without taking a big bite out of your backside on the way out.
But still, that thing about only with the permission of the state.
Well, then they're going to send you the passport when you send in your declaration. That's their permission, in essence, isn't it?
I don't know.
Well, if they're sending you the document and you've made a declaration and they agree with it, that's called tacit agreement.
But still, international law overrides their...
Battelle in the Law of Nations says every man's got the right of personal self-determination.
Well, I'm afraid the international law is made by military victories.
No. This is Battelle, the Law of Nations, not prize.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Not prize. Prize is, you know, like admiralty law. The remedy, this is why we're not under admiralty law, if any of you are out there in that misconception. The only remedy in admiralty law is prize. In maritime law, the remedy is a bill of libel. You see very much prize going around or bills of libel? No. You see lien, levy, garnishment, and seizure. Where are those remedies available? They're only available in two systems of law, the law merchant and the manorial law from the feudal era. Those are the only two bodies of law that those remedies are available in, period.
All right. Thank you for that clarification. Gentlemen, we are going to a break, and so we will be back in 3 minutes. Welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest today has been Roger Sales. He is the author of From Sovereign to Serf, Government by the Treachery and Deception of Words, and there is a good deal for that book at thebookshelf.us. His website is serfs-up.com, and of course that site is linked on today's schedule page. We have two more callers. Let's try and take them. Jeff in Vermont.
It's not named Richard?
No, Richard dropped.
Okay, I thought we were going to have a third one.
No. Yeah. No,
what
Richard's
you?
Only...
They only come in pairs. I was looking for a hat trick,
Deanna. Okay, Jeff in Vermont.
Yeah, I just got a comment. I live in Vermont and was part of this Patriot movement, and I've heard every single argument that he's purporting. I knew a guy named Ed Brown. I'm sure you guys heard of him. Me and my father went down to his house. We supported him. I think it was in 07. He's in jail. I've been to court on all the arguments that he said, between Christian Mavaman, WH, the IRS, everything. Everything has failed. I'd just be very weary.
Did you ever declare your correct status in a legal form, Jeffrey?
No, but I've had people in the Patriot movement do that. There's a guy up here, he's a real good guy, you know, has a couple thousand acres, he's got this huge library, this old farmhouse, and we as a group, we go and study law. We've done this for years. I don't do it that much anymore because it's kind of a dead end. But yeah, I've had people do the same thing. The thing is that you have to realize is that when you go into court, all the judge will say is take it up on appeal.
You don't have to go to court with this, Richard. You do it administratively. Administratively, agencies are a court of record also.
They'll put a warrant out.
You let them know in your jacket and in your information that they don't have any jurisdiction over you. You won't be in a court because the court won't have any jurisdiction over you either.
Yeah, then they put a warrant out for your arrest and you go to jail. You lose your driver's license.
When you got this information and a passport, you can go right down and get a non-resident driver's license. It's in every state driver's license code in the country, non-resident state-issued driver's license. But it says you have to have the hereditament, you have to be a national, and you have to prove that your parents were nationals. And that's what it says in the Oklahoma state traffic laws and the Texas state traffic laws and all the other ones because they're uniform.
All right, I'm just saying this. I've had a lot of friends go to jail using these methods, and you can do whatever you want. And I've heard these arguments before. You might be right. You might be absolutely 100% right, but these arguments do not work in court. That's all I'm going to say. People can try it. People can do whatever they want. From my experience using it, it does not work.
If you went to court and they had a resident jurisdiction over you, they ain't going to work.
Well, okay. There's no. Okay, all right. I'm just warning people. Thank you.
Thanks, Jeff. Okay, Joel in Wisconsin, real quick. We've only got a few seconds left. Joel, quick.
Okay, if somebody buys your book and reads it and understands it, would they have the same amount of ammunition that you just basically said everything today?
Yep.
Okay.
You're not going to get it reading it one time. I've got a guy that's extremely well-schooled. He's probably listening to this program. His name's Jim Prentice. He's a retired cop, and he was a Dan Metter research team leader for a number of years, and he said, Roger, your book's a masterpiece. I've read it 10 times in the first 2 weeks, and every time I read it, I got something different out of it. There's a lot of info in there.
All righty, gentlemen, we've run out of time. Thank you for your phone call. Roger, thank you for being on the program today. We'll do this again. And listeners, we'll talk tomorrow. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Ann. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you, Roger.